On. And again, I'm Dixie Noonan, and one of the lawyers on the staff here. And as you know, I'm sure, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was a bipartisan commission established by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. And one of the things that we are...
You haven't found out about that yet?
We are in the process of finding out about that, and the enabling statute tells us to look at a number of things. One of those being institutions that failed or would have failed, but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. And another area that we're focusing on that makes AIG particularly interesting is the role of complex financial derivatives in the financial crisis. So basically for those reasons, we're interested in talking to you today. So wanted to just give you that overview, and I and my colleagues have some specific questions, but I wondered if it might make sense just to start out with your general thoughts on what happened at AIG and why it ended up where it ended up in September of 2008.
Well, of course, I left the company in 2005. It was a very healthy company. And not being there, it's very difficult for me to say what happened. Obviously, the risk management controls that we had failed. Somebody managed it differently. We had a very good set of risk management controls. The insurance business is a risk business. And so we've grown up in a risk environment. And so we had risk management controls as part of our nature.
Do you think you could describe how the risk management function worked at AIG while you were there?
Yeah.
And also, if you could, I understand it wasn't something that started with the beginning of the company, so if you could give sort of a timeline.
Timeline of what?
Of the enterprise risk management.
Yeah, sure. Okay. We had two types of risk management, which made up an enterprise risk management, credit and market. I served on the New York Fed Board for a long time. I was chairman for 5 or 6 years. Before that, I was a director, then vice chair, then chair.
When were you chairman? What were the years?
Oh, forget the years.
Roughly?
I think in the late 80s, early 90s.
Okay.
In the 90s sometime. One of the long-serving people at the New York Fed, Chuck Lucas, was retiring, and I hired him to set up to work as part of the enterprise risk management team, which, so we had both credit and risk. And they reported to the CFO, and if there was any issue at any time, because they had a high priority. If any division of the company was not either paying attention or disregarding all kinds of bells and whistles went off.
So how would you, for example, manage credit risk? Would it involve setting capital behind positions? Would it involve...
Well, it was a very complex thing, but you'd have to analyze the business that you may be taking risk on and determine whether or not it had either adequate capital, were they overexposed or overextended, what were the people like, did they have a record, all the things that common sense would tell you. And these were followed religiously. There was no... risk management had a high priority in AIG. What happened after I was gone, I can't tell you.
So... about when would you have hired Chuck Lucas?
Chuck, I believe, came in the middle to late 90s. Before that, Bob Lewis was solely in charge of risk management. I understand he's still there.
That's my understanding as well. If you could specifically talk a little bit about the financial products unit... I guess they predated Chuck Lucas a little bit, starting in 1987.
Yeah.
If you could walk us through sort of how FP came to be part of AIG.
Sure. Senator Ribicoff gave me a call. We were good friends. And said, you ought to meet a chap by the name of Howard Sosin. He had been at Drexel, which blew up, as you know. I met with him, turned him over to Ed Matthews, who was my chief investment officer. And he came back, a week or so later. And we agreed to do a deal with him. It was kind of almost like a joint venture. It was 65-35, 65 to us, 35 to them.
Profits. Profit sharing.
Profit sharing. It was a fully hedged book. I mean, if he was doing a long-dated interest rate swap, they had a term out on the other side, and we worked on the difference between what you paid and what you got. And that was the arrangement. Soon after, I don't know, maybe 6 months or a year, he wanted to have the profits emerge when he did the transaction. And I said, no, it emerges when the profit emerges over a period of time. If it's a 10-year transaction, it emerges over 10 years, not before. He disagreed. So we had an agreement to disagree. And he departed the company. Tom Savage, who was a math PhD, was with the company at the time. Now, the reason we did this, we were a AAA-rated company. We needed to have AAA in order to do a derivative business at that time. You have to understand, diversification is risk management in itself on a broad basis. We were started as a property casualty company, very tiny, grew it, expanded our international business, added more diversification by doing that. Because the property casualty business has its soft periods, it has cycles. When rates go way down, judgment goes out the window, and you have to work your way through those cycles. And following rates down is not a great strategy. And so diversification was a better strategy. Introduced new products, all of which gave us diversification. We added in the international side, we ultimately got into 130 countries. We opened markets that had never been opened before, not only for insurance, but for financial services. I mean, we were a trailblazer in that regard. We were the first ones in Korea, all through Asia. We operated behind the Iron Curtain before the curtain came down in Hungary, Poland, and Romania. We were the first ones in Russia, throughout the world. And
so you saw adding the financial products joint venture
well,
as a...
We then built a life operation, which added further diversification. We had a tiny one when we started and became the largest. When you had the domestic and foreign, it was the largest life operation in the world. So we then began financial services in many countries, consumer finance, mostly in Asia and in Poland, and Latin America. And it was successful because we tied it into our insurance operations where we had a lot of leads that if followed up would have been, a lot of synergies. So when Sosin came along, we had a AAA rating, didn't require lots of capital to start up, and we had a pretty hedged business at that time. So now picking up, he leaves, Tom Savage comes in. Tom's a very sound, stable guy. He's a PhD math, very bright. Cassano was his operations guy. And that went along very fine. We had a separate board for FP. That was a separate from the AIG board, and several of the members of the AIG board were on that board, including Marty Felstein. And lawyers. It was a pretty good board, at least when I was there. Nothing could be done. No new product could be introduced in FP if it didn't pass muster with us. It had to.
And so what process was that?
Well, they would have to come. Savage would come and, you know, it was informally, come and discuss it. We'd have a meeting of my CFO, head of risk management, the head of investments. We'd listen to it. And you agree, disagree, make changes, whatever. We also had a lot of auditing functions. Not only internal audit from AIG, but our outside auditor looked at it. And we built a system off-site that mimicked every transaction that went on to make sure we came up with the same answers that they had. Okay? And the auditing firm, PwC, had an off-site of their own, I believe it was at Duke University, that also mimicked the major transactions to ensure that they were came out with the same result. But then some of them are kind of complex.
Just for the financial products unit?
Just for the financial products unit. Right. No, things went along quite fine. We had no problem. Then Tom Savage is married to a Brazilian gal. She did not want to live up north any longer. He had a choice of either moving to Brazil or to Florida. So he chose Florida, and that's where he is today. We speak from time to time. He stayed on the board for, I think, a year or two after he retired. And we were sorry to lose him. He was a good man.
Had he been at Financial Products from its inception?
I believe so. I believe so.
Okay.
He came with Sosa.
Okay.
So he knew something about it. And he was a very thoughtful guy. So that's the genesis of FP.
So the risk management and the sort of operational oversight was that you described, was that something that was, how was that ever formalized in any policies or agreements, or was this just sort of an understanding that that's how business was to be done?
Well, I don't know what you mean formalized.
Put on paper.
Maybe.
Was there anything that would have required Mr. Savage to come to you when he introduced a new product?
If he didn't, he wouldn't be there. We had rules of engagement, and those were very clear.
One related question I wanted to ask about, it's my understanding that AIG FP had an unconditional guarantee by the parent company. Is that correct?
I don't think that's correct. We would approve all guarantees. They didn't have an unconditional, unlimited guarantee. They would have to come and get approval for any kind of... my recollection is that they had to come and get approval for any kind of guarantees. It wasn't just they could just write their own ticket.
If I were going to try to figure out now what those guarantees might have looked like, would it have been in memos approving transactions? Would it have been in...
Well, the day-to-day people who were operating there was Bill Dooley, who sold the company. And they'd report through him day-to-day. We had staff meetings. So we knew what was going on a weekly basis. He was at those meetings. So there was no lack of communications.
Okay. And he would know, presumably,
yeah, he would know
how all this worked.
Yeah.
Mr. Greenberg, this is Gary Cohen. He's our general counsel. Lee Woloski, Mr. Greenberg's lawyer from Boies Schiller.
How many lawyers in this room?
more than are needed.
Gary, Jay, and I are lawyers.
So am I.
Okay. Right, NYU, right?
I graduated in 50.
I read that, yeah. Are you NYU?
No, I'm New York Law School.
New York Law School. Okay. Okay. That's right. That's right. But you didn't practice law.
No, I didn't have the patience for it.
It is tedious. Sometimes.
How did you... You talked a little bit about the profit sharing split between FP and AIG.
It changed after Sosin left. Okay. It then became... I think it was 70-30, and they're required to put 50% of the profit back in the, stay in the company, at risk as capital, and it came out over 5 years.
And this is because I think you were mentioning earlier that there was a disagreement between you and Sosin about...
About the long-dated transactions, and that, that he wanted the profit emerging now, and I said it would emerge as it emerged.
And so was that... The resolution?
That was the resolution.
So they were not allowed to take the profits out up front? When
my understanding is, because I was gone 5 years, that about $690 million of capital that belonged to them was lost.
That's in the 2008, once everything...
Yeah.
What do you mean lost?
Well, everything that FP had was... they had a big loss, as you well
right,
know.
Right.
And part of that big loss was their capital.
Okay.
So that deferred compensation was put into as capital of the company.
That's right.
All right.
Did you have more questions on the risk manager?
I was curious about what sort of information you would get in these meetings.
Well, we had a staff meeting of very senior people. Once a week on a, I think it was Tuesday morning, which had the CFO, the Chief Investment Officer, Bill Dooley, that who covered FP and covered also foreign exchange, the head of life insurance, head of general insurance, mm-hmm. etc. And that meeting covered all aspects of the business.
Mm-hmm.
Anything unusual was brought up at that meeting. Separate and apart from that meeting, if there were a new product that that FP was thinking about, and they'd either come and make a presentation, we'd be on the telephone, and mm-hmm. Dooley would be in the room, the chief investment officer, the chief financial officer. We'd discuss it. You know, we had some informal, some formal. You know, okay. Running a big company.
It's right, and you said in your congressional testimony that occasionally you would say no to financial products.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Do you
I say no to lots of people.
Do you remember any particular products that they wanted to?
Not as I sit here.
Okay. All right.
Everything wasn't yes, if that's what you mean. No.
Right, right.
Of course not.
But you don't. Did you approve the PNC transaction? PNC Bank. This was something that was investigated in 2004.
Yeah.
How is that relevant to the scope?
Just because of the risk management
controls.
The PNC, yes, I remember that. That was presented to the FP board, okay, board meeting, and a presentation was made by Cassano and his general counsel. General counsel's name, his father had been the head of Ford. Red, what the hell was his name?
We have his name.
Okay.
Not coming to me at the moment.
They had gotten, they ran the proposed transaction through an outside accounting firm and a law firm.
Mm-hmm.
And both said it was perfectly proper. They made that presentation to the board. The board was relying on both of those entities mm-hmm. to say it was perfectly proper.
Right. Okay.
So you said there was, I just want to clarify, you said there was overlap between the AIG board and the AIG FP board.
Yeah.
Did you sit on the AIG FP board ever?
Yeah.
The whole time you were
yeah.
at the company?
Yeah.
Okay. So you were there at that presentation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, heard it. We questioned them. You know, they We saw the opinions. I'm not practicing law, I'm running a business.
So, sort of switching, I want to switch back a little bit to the business of financial products.
Yeah.
And was it always a derivatives business? It started as a derivatives business?
Yeah.
Did it ever grow into anything else?
No, their business was derivatives. We had everything else.
When did FP first start doing credit derivatives, to your knowledge?
I think the first time we did any of that was with the European banks. When Basel II came in, it was cheaper for the banks. Basel II said that, if my recollection's right, that they had to put up a capital charge even for lines of credit that were not being exercised. So that put a lot of strain on them. FP worked out a transaction with them that was less costly and good for them and good for FP. Now, we took some of that business in the lower, the higher risk layers in a private company, Star International, which was privately held, the largest shareholder at that time. And so we know how that ran off. It was five years, and there was never a loss to it. So if Star International did well, obviously AIG had to do well on that set of
For clarification, you're saying Star did these transactions before AIG of P?
About the same time.
The sort of model you sort of borrowed
so.
It.
Okay. I believe so. That was the first. You asked me the first time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
My knowledge is.
Do you remember about when that would have been?
No.
Late 90s, maybe?
It could be.
If you wouldn't mind, we can walk through this. I can sort of walk through what I understand the business lines were. It'd be great if you could just walk us through the evolution of the credit derivatives business at Financial Products as you understand it.
Well, that was the first time that I can recall right now that we did that. And it worked out fine. Mm-hmm.
So you continued to do these regulatory capital derivatives. And then at any point
did
that...
It wasn't huge. It was kind of modest at the time. And the size of AIG at the time, it wasn't a big deal.
And at some point, AIG FP started writing credit derivative protection on asset-backed pools that contained mortgage assets.
Yeah, but remember, in the late 90s and early 2000, there was nothing wrong in the housing market.
Do you recall when FP would have first started writing credit protection on those types of assets?
I think it was early in 2000, 2001, 2, something like that. And it wasn't a huge business. I mean, it was very modest.
Maybe I should ask, what do you consider a huge business?
Well, you look at the size of AIG. I think from inception to the time I left, I think we made $5 billion in FB, and AIG was way up there. We had almost $1 trillion of assets when I left the company.
So the contracts that the financial products unit would have used on these transactions, would those have been reviewed by anyone at the parent company?
Well, Dooley was the responsible officer, but I presume that, and he may have talked to the general counsel, our legal department, but I didn't read contracts.
You read some of them.
No, I didn't.
You didn't. Contracts. You didn't read any of them.
No.
Was anyone at the board of AIG FP ever told about the provisions in the contracts, how they worked? Not just sort of the deal terms, but
I don't recall.
And what I'm specifically interested in, and this became clear much later and led to a lot of the problems that were ultimately experienced, were the collateral provisions in the contract.
But remember, my recollection that when credit default swaps first came into being, there was no, if you were AAA, there was no requirement for collateral. ISDA had a meeting, if my recollection is correct, in 2005 or thereabouts, called by some of the banks that changed the rules. It doesn't mean that you couldn't have had a contract that differed from any of that. There was, obviously, it was up to the two parties to negotiate whenever they wanted to negotiate. But the two changes called for collateral if you were downgraded, your ratings were downgraded, or if the CDO was downgraded. That obviously was a earth-shattering change. In 2005, after March, I was no longer there.
So those are both provisions that I understand were in the AIGFP contracts, and we'll have to go back and check whether they were there before 2005 or not. As I understand it, at least $20 billion of the
multi-sector book was written. Yeah, but remember, when your AAA rating, it made no difference. If you lost your rating, it made a difference.
So the other provision that we're aware of is not with respect to a downgrade of AIG or with respect to a downgrade of the bonds in the deals, but a decline in the market value of the assets underlying.
Well, but that's the same thing we're talking about. The value of the bond would obviously affect its price. But the fact of the matter is, there was no exchange. There was no price discovery. Different dealers were marking them differently. One banker had the lowest marks going. Obviously, you know, did you have to respond to that? I don't think so.
Well, it's curious. In the contracts, the dealer, quote unquote, is the person who has the final say on the marks of the assets.
Yeah, but if...
And the AIGFP contracts, the dealer was AIGFP's counterparty, which gave them, I would say, a significant amount of...
Well, you know, I would disagree with that. I don't
Why?
Know what the contract would say. If you found out that the dealer had the lowest price and couldn't justify that, I'd say take a hike.
Even if the contractual provision was that it was the dealer's call?
Yeah, but listen... You have to be honest about it. You can't have a fictitious number that you can't support. If you can't support the number, meet me in court.
Were you aware of AIGFP having a process by which it valued its book of business on a regular, ongoing basis?
Well, it wasn't...
What basis would AIGFP have to dispute the dealer's marks, I guess, is my question.
Well, you go around the market and find out what the marks were.
But you wouldn't have internally sort of modeled that.
I don't recall that.
Can I just to try to just remind you of something that you know, but just I think it would be helpful just to put it in context, which is that, at the time Mr. Greenberg left AIG, AIG had almost 100,000 employees and it operated in 130 countries around the world. And as CEO of this enterprise,
I did more than focus on FP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of the point.
Understood.
I'm getting at. I think it would be, I think we can basically, you know, agree that it wouldn't have been reasonable to assume that Mr. Greenberg would have, you know, been aware of the specific contract terms on particular credit default swap arrangements or any other, you know, transaction in Uzbekistan or whatever it was that AIG may have been doing at the time.
And I appreciate it when you've told us that you don't have knowledge of those. If you don't have personal knowledge, that's all we need to know.
Okay.
Thanks for that clarification. Still going to ask one other question, and this actually has to do with what happened immediately following your departure. On March 14th of 2005, AIG got downgraded from AAA to AA. And the reports in the press are that the financial products unit, because of that downgrade, were required to post $1.15 billion in collateral on various contracts. Would you have any knowledge of why?
No.
Or what contractual provisions would have triggered that?
No.
Would that have been a material? I mean, help me put this in perspective. I am a practicing lawyer, not a business person. Would a $1.15 billion collateral posting have been a big deal to the FP board?
Yeah, it would have been a big deal to the FP board. A billion and a half is still a lot of money. no matter how big you are.
What sort of conversations would that have triggered and controls being reviewed?
Well, should have been asking why. Explain it.
I know you had a question about the regulatory arbitrage book. Was that covered already? Because we talked about that.
I did have a question about Deutsche and Goldman.
Okay.
In January of this year.
Year.
Yes, you had an interview with the Wall Street Journal, in which you said that I don't know whether Goldman Sachs was the force behind the change or Deutsche Bank. That's something investigative reporters are going to have to spend time digging out. What sort of information were you hearing and from whom? I mean, what were you basing that comment on?
Well, there was a change.
Right, I understand the change.
And somebody called, somebody was leading the charge on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea who it was, and I thought investigative reporters should be investigating that.
Right. Why Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank in particular?
Well, who had the lowest marks on the street?
Okay. They were presumably Goldman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who else would you recommend we talk to about the operational and risk management controls at the Financial Products Unit?
Well, Bill Dooley. Bob Lewis, obviously Cassano.
Would it make any sense to go back in time, talk to people like Mr. Savage, or?
You know, he can't hurt.
But Dooley and Lewis and Cassano are the people that would have the most intimate knowledge of that.
Dooley is there now. Bob Lewis is there now. Cassano was there.
And those would have been the principal people that you talked to as well about this business.
Yeah.
I want to shift gears away from FP a little bit and ask you about the securities lending business. Was that going at the time you were still
sure.
CEO? What does that date back to? I'm not as familiar, I'll admit, with the securities lending business.
It goes back quite a ways in time. A life company is sitting on lots of securities. Many of the banks want to borrow them.
Why would they be sitting on the securities? They're just invested in them because they get premiums
investing.
In?
You're matching assets and liabilities. And so you have a lot of securities. If you're successful, you have a lot of them. They want to borrow them for a period of time. You make any from 3 to 5 basis points instead of having them sitting in the vault. They sit in the bank for 30 days. And they generally were invested in short-term receivables. And usually 30 days, and they roll if they had a roll. But you made you made whatever it was, 3 to 5 or sometimes 6 basis points. And there was no risk involved. And that's the way it ran.
So to your knowledge, what were the ultimate problems in the securities lending business that led to some of the need for assistance in that area?
Very simple. They didn't go for 3 to 5 basis points. They wanted 30 basis points. The only place you can get it. Now, this goes back after I left the company. So
you were still a pretty big shareholder, right?
Pardon me?
You were still a pretty large shareholder,
yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, but, I was out of the company. Shareholders don't run the company.
Understood.
And they went out and got 30 basis points in housing assets. And, obviously they went long, and that was the wrong thing to do. It was never done that way.
And that's because those became illiquid?
Yeah, and they went down in value. So when they had a return, they couldn't. They were short of funds.
So with that business...
But that could have been managed. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, that shouldn't have happened, number one. And if they didn't have the FP problem, that could have been managed.
How are they linked is a question that I'm sort of trying to figure out. How are the problems in FP linked to the problems in the securities lending business?
Well, they were, except they were both exposed in the housing area.
So it's just the fact that they were both exposed in the housing area at the same time.
The securities lending assets that they were taking this cash and investing it in how? Investing it instead of short term, they're investing it longer term.
Would the opposite of your statement have been true, that without the securities lending problems, you could have managed, the company could have managed the problems in the financial products unit?
It could have been managed if they, well, first of all, what they should have done when they lost their AAA rating and left the company, should have hedged the entire book.
It wasn't hedged before then?
As far as I knew, AAA rating, they didn't have to hedge. They didn't have that much. They went out and wrote a lot.
Mm-hmm.
By all, you know, I'm reading that. I wasn't there.
Right.
And they wrote an awful lot. They wrote as much in 9 months, I'm told, after I left. And they wrote in the entire history of FP. So what they should have done is, they shouldn't have written that much.
Mm-hmm.
Two, if they did, they should have hedged it. And there was an ABX index that could have been hedged out. It would have cost some money, but a hell of a lot less than what they wound up doing.
Now, the ABX didn't really go online until a little later.
But you could have hedged.
What would you have done?
What would I have done?
I mean, how would you hedge?
Before the ABX came into being, what other strategy could you have used to hedge that book?
There were other dealers around, and you'd hedge out. There's always somebody. It may cost you some money.
It's the price that's the...
Yeah, but that's a lot cheaper.
So, back to securities lending for just a minute then. The AIG was investing in mortgage-related assets to get a higher basis point return.
That's what it appears to be.
And would that have...
wasn't there.
So that was not the business at the time you left the company.
No.
It was the 3 to 5 basis points.
That's right.
And so, which would have allowed the company to just invest in treasuries and still carry on with that business.
Yeah. That's correct.
So I guess we'll have to ask someone else how the risk management changed there after 2005.
You can ask Win Neuger. He ran that area.
Well, one question that I have is, Win Neuger was at AIG, the parent company, is that right? He was the investment officer?
He succeeded Ed Matthews. Ed Matthews was still there on a consulting basis, but he took over.
And Ed Matthews was the person that worked with you initially in setting up financial products. When did Win Neuger take over that position?
I say we left in 2005, probably in 2004 or late 2003.
Is there anything else you think that we need to know about the securities lending business? Anything else that you can be helpful on?
It's very simple. Shouldn't have done what they did.
I'm going to switch gears now and ask a little bit about the Office of Thrift Supervision.
Which?
The Office of Thrift Supervision.
Was the regulator.
Exactly. Could you describe how OTS came to be AIG's regulator?
Well, we had to pick somebody.
Why did you have to pick somebody?
You had to have a regulator.
Why? Who said that?
I think my legal department told us that.
So?
I don't recall specifically, but I believe it was a legal department.
Okay. So you had to have a regulator.
Yeah.
So how did OTS come to be the regulator?
Well, we're being regulated on the insurance side by the states, mm-hmm. Or by foreign jurisdictions that we were in, both the life and the non-life side. In the states, every state has an insurance superintendent. They regulated that business. The only thing that wasn't regulated, therefore, was FP. And
Your aircraft leasing.
Yeah, well, aircraft leasing, I don't know if anybody regulates that.
Yeah. But
there was no regulator for that, not yet.
Mm-hmm.
There may be.
Right. But the losses or the profits would go into the general pot, is basically my point.
What do you mean?
Into the parent company.
Into the parent company.
Well, ultimately, the shares of... you're talking about the shares of ILFC?
Mm-hmm.
ILFC was owned in different entities. Part of it was in the parent, part of it was in some of the subsidiaries. Mm-hmm. And so the profits...
Mm-hmm.
And, the profits would be... Between profits and dividends, we kept as much capital there as, mm-hmm. as possible because we, it was a growing entity.
So when was it that your legal department told you that you needed to find a regulator?
No, I don't recall the date.
Roughly?
I'd be guessing.
After Financial Products became a joint venture?
Yeah, it was always a joint venture.
Starting in 1987.
You're talking about after Sosin left?
I'm trying to help pinpoint when the search for a regulator began.
Well, I think it was in the early 90s, I think, you know. I can't swear to that.
And what process did the company use to evaluate who should be its regulator?
I don't know.
Who led that evaluation?
It'd probably be the legal department, general counsel, and the CFO.
Did AIG have a regulator before then? Before
well,
OTS?
Sort of a consolidated or an umbrella regulator?
Well, you know, under New York law, mm-hmm. the insurance superintendent is a holding company act, and we were a holding company. Okay. And the insurance superintendent had the right to look at anything at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So did the New York State Insurance Department do regular reviews of AIG?
Of the insurance subs, but they had the right to look at anything.
But they didn't actually invoke that right.
Not that I can recall.
Were you involved at all in the OTS becoming the AIG parent company, holding company regulator?
I don't believe so.
So you wouldn't have...
They may have just told me about it, but I didn't take part in it, and I can recall the decision to choose it.
Do you ever remember the New York State Insurance Department superintendent coming to AIG and sort of pitching or doing any presentations on becoming the holding company supervisor?
Well, they were. Yes.
No, I don't.
No, they were, by law, they had a right to look at anything.
But I mean at the time that you were searching for the regulator that ultimately ended up being the
recall.
OTS. You don't remember that. Would you have been involved in that?
I doubt it.
Would this have been a board issue?
It might have been reported at a board meeting by the CFO. Or the general counsel.
And you said the primary reason for needing a regulator was because of the financial products unit?
No, I didn't say that.
We're talking about things that happened, you know, 20 years ago, which he's already indicated to you pretty clearly he doesn't have a very concrete recollection of. So I just want you to be respectful of that, you know, in the types of questions that you're asking. I'd like to ask that you please do that, you know, because I don't want... You know, I think that it's clear that some of his answers are speculative. It may have been reported to the board. It might have been the CFO. You know, and I just want to, you know, I just want to ask you to be mindful of things that you're asking about occurred 2 decades ago. And he already said he doesn't really remember the specifics of it. I don't want, you know, I don't want anyone to, you know, try to. I don't want there to be. Any suggestion that he's giving responses that someone may later construe to be inaccurate, you know, because you're asking very detailed questions again about things that happened a long time ago, which he already said he doesn't have a specific recollection of.
Well, and to the extent that he doesn't have a recollection, I believe that you've been able to say that. Is that right, Mr. Greenberg?
I've been trying to, but if you're hearing me.
If I'm not, which I promise you I am, and if I'm not, I know that the tape recorder is. So so I hope that will ease any concerns that you may have. I don't think it's an unfair question to say, is something like the decision to decide who the parent company regulator is, would that have been a board decision?
I agree. I don't think it's unfair.
Thank you. So those are all my questions on that, so you had no need to worry. Just wanted to briefly talk about the bailout. I think you've been relatively vocal about your thoughts on what the government did with AIG during the bailout and what you might have done differently, and I'm just hoping to get sort of in your own words here instead of reading what we've already heard you testify, if you could just sort of tell us now and help us explain, and maybe we could sort of ask some follow-up questions. I'd be curious to hear.
Well, what do you want to know?
Did you take issue with the way that the government handled the bailout of AIG?
Well, to the extent that what I've read is accurate, yes.
Why?
Well, when AIG lost its AAA rating, it had a liquidity problem. Didn't have a solvency problem. Those are two big different things. When Citigroup needed help, the Fed guaranteed hundreds of billions of dollars of assets for them. All that needed to be done, in my humble opinion, since the government took 79.9% of AIG, on the basis of what valuation, I have not been able to find any place. But there was a valuation that justified taking 79.9% or charging 14.5% interest on the $85 million loan, roughly 14.5%. Kind of usurious when that was done. And the next day, on Meet the Press, Hank Paulson said, we're going to liquidate AIG. I thought that was a fairly draconian step. All that needed to be done was to have the Fed, since they owned 79.9%, essentially one basis point under a consolidating equity, there was other legal issues why they couldn't take 80%, is to put a guarantee under FP. FP then would have been AAA. There wouldn't have been any collateral calls required. And due course, that would have worked its way out. There was a recovery in many parts of the asset base. And so, you know, that certainly was a more preferable solution than the solution of taking 79.9%, charging a usurious rate of interest, and saying we're going to liquidate the company. AIG was the largest insurance company in history. It was a national asset for many reasons. And I thought that was a wrong solution.
Could you talk a little bit more about why it was a national asset?
No.
Is there, I mean, what's the basis for that?
There are some things that companies overseas, American companies, do that are helpful to our government.
Like what?
I'd rather not talk about that.
Okay. Is there someone else I could talk to about that, or something I could read that would help me understand that?
I don't know if that's possible.
Why don't we talk offline about it?
Okay. Okay.
You have to shut your machine off.
Okay. We can talk offline about it. I think you also, one of the things.
Do you want to go off record now and get an explanation on that before we go on? I just think we should probably have a
sure
conversation.